Dylan Thomas's most famous lines are these, and I think you'll recognize them. Do not go gentle into that good night. Old age should burn and rage at the close of day. Rage, rage against the dying of the light. I come today to vanquish Dylan Thomas. At least those lines of his. I come today to ask you, to encourage you, to plead with you, do go gentle into that good night. Not the old age part. That part I hope you all, I hope that we all will burn and rave and be alive while we are alive. Even as our bodies ache. But also, I ask you, I beseech you, I entreat you for the dying of the light part. Do not rage. Do not resist. Instead, turn to it. Bring with it your curiosity. See it. Rather than the preconceptions between you and it. Do the work now in this light that allows you in the dying of the light a final, magnificent opportunity to be awake. There is a famous lesson from the Buddha called the Two Arrows Parable, and this can be found in the original teachings that the Buddha shared and were later written down. In this case, it comes from the Salatha Sutta. And in it, the Buddha was speaking to monks, people who were intentionally trying to follow the path and become enlightened. And he said that the untrained person feels pain, and that is like being shot with one arrow. It hurts. There's no denying it. It's real. It may even cause injury. This is all true. However, the untrained person, that's me, that's you, that's all of us, or most of us at the very least, we respond to the pain of one arrow and react as if we've been hit by a second arrow, bringing fear, bringing anger, bringing a sense of betrayal, all sorts of secondary emotional responses that amplify pain, turning it into suffering. The Buddha said, and in this lesson, like I said, he was teaching monks, that with training, one can learn to feel just that one arrow and not invite the second. Our modern interpretation has boiled this lesson down, and sometimes you'll see on the internet, as if it's a quote from Siddhartha Gautama, pain is inevitable, suffering is optional. But the Buddha never really said that, just to be super clear. Death scares us. Dying scares us. Even when we say that we're not scared, even when we think that we're not scared, we are more alike to Woody Allen's joke than we'd like to think. I'm not afraid of death. I just don't want to be there when it happens. I don't usually like to quote Woody Allen. I'm not a fan of his. But that one I brought up. So we turn away from the fact of death and its inevitability. We build vast and robust economies on its denial. We flood our senses with all sorts of speculation. We even put them and call them scripture. All sorts of preconceived notions and longings, and in so doing, we invite second arrows rather than preparing ourselves for the one. It's worth our while to reflect on what we actually mean when we use the word death. Yes, there is the literal level whereby we recognize physical indications of death, heart no longer beating, cessation of breath. But you might be surprised how what seems obvious and empirical is actually culturally bound and open to argument. For instance, while the medical establishment says that brain dead is dead dead, that state does not involve the stopping of systole and diastole or the termination of exhale and inhale. Among indigenous Tibetans, as well as modern Westerners who follow Tibetan Buddhism, there is an understanding that the death of the body is a process taking more or less 3 days. And therefore, this is the basis of how to respond when a loved one dies. Beyond the literal understanding of death, there are a host of murky thoughts, disturbing emotions, not to mention a crowd of theories and preconceived notions, some which are available to our consciousness, but many of which are not. They are deep. And wise people, in particular, one of the wise people who is my go-to person for my own befriending death meditation practice, her name is Judith Leaf. She tells us that if we do not surface these attitudes and bring our awareness to them, it is to our own detriment. Not because we miss out on the so-called correct view of death. We're Unitarian Universalists. We don't believe in any single correct view of much of anything. But because these preconceptions have real effects on our lives. According to Leaf, and I agree with her, she says, they determine how we relate to death ourselves and how we relate to people who are dying. When our experience is distorted by speculation, it is difficult to see clearly. We lose the ability to distinguish what we know directly from what we have heard secondhand, what we believe on faith, what we cook up with our own fears, on what is wishful thinking. So it is important to bring our own personal assumptions to light to find out what they are. They impact not just our attitudes toward dying, our experience of death, but they impact our appreciation for what it means to be alive in this moment, like we heard from the reading before. And with that in mind, I offer to you this poem from Mary Oliver. Perhaps you're familiar with it. It's called When Death Comes. When death comes, like the hungry bear in autumn, when death comes and takes all the bright coins from his purse to buy me, and then snaps that purse shut, when death comes like the measles pox, when death comes like an iceberg between the shoulder blades, I want to step through the door full of curiosity, wondering, what is it going to be like, that cottage of darkness? And therefore, I look upon everything as a brotherhood and a sisterhood, and I look upon time as no more than an idea, and I consider eternity as another possibility, and I think of each life as a flower, as common as a field daisy, and as singular. And each name a comfortable music in the mouth, tending as all music does towards silence. And each body a lion of courage and something precious to the earth. When it's over, I want to say all my life, I was a bride married to amazement. I was the bridegroom taking the world into my arms. When it's over, I don't want to wonder if I have made of my life something particular or real. I don't want to find myself sighing and frightened or full of argument, I don't want to end up simply having visited this world. That poem has in one of its lines one of my life goals. I want to step through the door full of curiosity, wondering, what is it going to be like, that cottage of darkness? Now, to be clear, I don't seek to die earlier than I am supposed to. For you social workers out there, you do not need to be doing a suicide assessment. I do not court death. I am happy to be here now, to be alive in this moment. My curiosity does not draw me closer to the date in the future, I hope, long in the future, while I exist in this life. But whenever death happens, it is my hope that rather than turn away, I will turn with curiosity. Candidly, I kind of expected that there would be an emptier house today than usual, given the topic, and that you can find it out ahead of time. And I haven't asked Carlos how many people we have today. I'll find out afterwards. But in fact, at the cabaret last night, which was fabulous, by the way, thank you to those who put it on, there was someone there who said they would not be coming today, not for this topic. And I get it. It's not the easiest topic. In the past, my husband has sometimes called the degree of my interest in this topic on the morbid side. Can you hear that with a wee Yorkshire accent? Befriending death has been part of my meditation practice for many years, on and off. I like to think that besides making me a better person, it makes me a better minister. But to be clear, I'm not preaching on this topic because I already have it down. I don't, by any stretch. I am preaching on this and planning for great things in the fall because I do not have it down. Because most of us do not have this down. And because I'm not ready to die yet, and like any of us, any day I could. Because when I get even the littlest bit sick, I'm amazed at the unbidden fear-based stories that occupy my mind and send my imagination to places that I did not know existed. And my hope is that you, maybe all of you, but at least some of you, will accept my invitation that we walk this walk together, learning and delighting and comforting and coping together. My mind is bright with ideas, not all of which will come to fruition. That is true of all ministry. I've been in conversation, in particular with Esther Barkun, decades-long friend of the society and retired geriatric social worker, and she and I have been hatching plans, and we are looking for some more accomplices. I'd like for Tess to host a death cafe. A simple event concept that started in France and takes place all over the world, where people come together, gather in small circles, and talk death, and this is the important part, eat cake. You may not call it a death cafe unless you are serving cake. Trademark law, right? Esther is kind of hoping that everyone will read a book called When Breath Becomes Air. I haven't read it yet, but she says that it is such an inspiration about how to face death and live a more vibrant life. So maybe the monthly book group might take that up. I've had conversations with too many of you, and discovered that so many of you do not have advanced directives or healthcare proxies. This means that if you come into a serious medical condition, your loved ones and medical providers won't know your wishes. And friends, if you are under 50 and you're not listening to me, this is not just for our elders. This is for all of us. So we need to think about hosting a workshop where we can learn about these things and make promises to one another to get them done. Perhaps you know this, but it turns out that there is one and only one green burial cemetery here in New Jersey. Do you know where it is? Yeah, so it's in the Pine Barrens. Say it again.
It's where Kitty, Steelmantown.
Steelmantown. It's where Kitty is buried. So I'm planning a visit. I've already reached out to the guy who runs it, and I kind of think that would be an awesome field trip.
What makes it
neat? So basically, you can be buried in a shroud. There is no chemicals going through your body, so there's none of that embalming thing. You can also be buried in a wicker coffin, anything that decomposes. There's no vaults. And the tombstones, if you choose to have one, are natural stones, and they lay flat. And some of them actually have a capacity to continue to preserve land for this purpose. So there are multiple ways of doing it. It's kind of intriguing. I'm also hoping that we'll have a workshop on writing your own obituary. I think that would be fun, but then again, I'm a minister, and we have a strange sense of what's fun. But like I said, we need more accomplices to make this happen. So if you're interested, please let me or Esther know. Last month, there was a piece in the New York Times called First Sex Ed, Then Death Ed. It was written by a medical doctor, Jessica Zitter, in the Bay Area, who had taught sex ed to her daughter's middle school class, and then years later taught death ed to a different daughter's class, this time in high school. And I was like, what a thought. I love OWL. I love our whole lives sexuality curriculum. What a great addition to bring along a curriculum based on death. Here is what Zitter wrote in that article that motivated her. And remember, she's a doctor. Many of the patients I have cared for at the end of their lives had no idea they were dying, despite raging illnesses and repeated hospitalizations. The reasons for this are complex and varied, among them poor physician training in breaking bad news, and a collective hope that our technologies will somehow ultimately triumph against death. By the time patients are approaching the end, they are often too weak and disabled to express preferences, if those preferences were ever even considered before. Patients aren't getting what they say they want. For example, 80% of Americans would prefer to die at home, but only 20% achieve that wish. Many of us would choose to die in a planned, comfortable way, surrounded by those we love. But you can't plan for a good death if you don't know you're dying. We need to learn how to make a place for death in our lives, and we need also to learn how to plan for it. She continues, in most cases, the suffering could have been avoided or at least mitigated by some education on death and our medical system. The fact is that when patients are prepared, they die better. When we have done the work of considering their goals and values and we have documented those preferences, they make different choices. What people want when it comes to end-of-life care is almost never as much as what we give them. So the moment of death, the moments of dying and the physical and emotional discomfort that come with it, these are much harder to not be overwhelmed by unless we have spent time in our days and years and decades facing towards rather than away. And this is the thing. It's one of human existence's deep paradoxical truths. For most people, and I won't say all, but for most people, facing and engaging with death now brings an unparalleled sweetness and awareness to life that you are living now, an awareness of life and its precious qualities unavailable in any other way. So I'm going to affirm that this practice is not morbid, and Tony's changed his mind on that as well, but is a gift. A gift to yourself, a gift to those whom you love when they are close to death, a gift to this death-denying culture, and in my opinion, a necessary act of both political and spiritual resistance. May we all find the ability to cultivate what that poet Mary Oliver so beautifully described as wanting to step through the door full of curiosity. And let us end with those beautiful words from Mark Morrison Reed. Let me die laughing, savoring one of life's crazy moments. Let me die holding the hand of the one I love and recalling that I tried to love and was loved in return. Let me die remembering that life has been good and that I did what I could. But today, just remind me that I am dying so that I can live, savor, and love with all my heart. Amen, and blessed be.